Whoa, hey, skip the repeat. Hey there, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Skip the Repeat. My guest today is Dave Zirkle. A dedicated educator, Zirkle students have enjoyed numerous musical and professional successes under his direction. He has had multiple winners in the Leonard Falcone competition, the solo competition of the International 2B Phoneme Conference, and the National Music Teachers National Association solo competition. Alumni from his studio have performed with the Cleveland Orchestra, Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and the New York Philharmonic. Many others are leading successful teaching careers at the secondary and post-secondary level. Zirkle joins the University of Michigan from the University of Georgia, where he is a professor of tuba and euphonium. In addition to his work in higher education, Zirkle leads an active career as a performer. He has performed with orchestras including the Philadelphia Orchestra, New York Phil, Chicago Orchestra, Symphony Orchestra, Atlanta Symphony, National Symphony, Baltimore Symphony, and the Kennedy Center Opera House Orchestra. He is a member of the Brass Band of Battle Creek, was a founding member for the Washington Symphonic Brass, and has performed with the Burning River Brass. He began his performing career as a member of the United States Army Field Band and the United States Army Band. Zirkle has performed as a featured soloist at many workshops and symposia, including the Leonard Falcone Festival, several international 2B Phoneme Conferences, and the United States Army Band Tuba Conference. In addition, he has performed as a solo recitalist at many of the leading colleges and conservatories in the United States. His first solo CD, American Music for Tuba, Something Old, Something New, was selected as the recipient of the inaugural ITEA Roger Bobo Award for Excellence in Recording at the 2006 ITEC in Denver, Colorado. His subsequent CD, Tuba Helper, was a Bobo finalist in 2008. He is also a former president of the International Tuba Euphonium Association. So Dave, welcome to the show. Thanks you so much for being here. How are you doing today?
Doing great. Thanks. Happy to be here.
So you've been in the Army and in Georgia. Which one has more guns?
I would have to say the Army, but that's where I really learned to foster my hatred of guns was in the Army, and then it only grew in Georgia. So
yeah. So I guess go ahead.
That was a trip for me because I had never fired a weapon before going off to basic training, and then I find myself marching down the street with a rifle in my hands, singing songs about killing people I don't know. So for me, that was a little bit of a twist.
Sure. Yeah. This is something I feel like, I guess has never come up with any military band person that I've talked to. Do you, once you're in, do you have to do like weapons tests as part of your yearly, what's the word I'm looking for? Training, I guess.
Yeah, I think with the military bands, there's a special designation as far as careers go. In the Army, it was O2 Sierra, which means that you're a special bands person. It says all sorts of things about what's going to happen to you, like accelerated rank and permanent duty station. But one of those things, in the premier bands, nobody has to qualify on weapons once you get out of basic training. So
gotcha. Okay.
Cheerfully. So
yeah. All right. So before we get into some more questions, we are, as always, going to do our first segment of the show. It is time for
On This Day in Music History.
It's time for On This Day in Music History, and Dave, you have joined me on one of the most important days in music history. On this day in 1965, a Rolling Stones concert at the Adelphi Theater in Dublin, Ireland, halts after 12 minutes due to a riot. So have you ever had an audience turn on you?
Not quite so viscerally. I think internally many audience members have turned on me, but there's never been a riot.
They've never, shown it publicly. Well, how about this? Have you ever gotten into a performance and kind of known something was off or something weird might happen?
Boy, at the risk of sounding, boring, there was one recital, a faculty recital that I did at the University of Georgia, where it was a big recital. I was doing a large program that included the John Williams Concerto, and halfway through the first movement of the John Williams Concerto, my valves froze up this is a good sponsorship plug, on my PT-15, and it froze up and I couldn't go on, and somebody hustled backstage to try and help me, and we all just shook our head, ruefully and decided that what the show was not to go on with that instrument. So yeah. I had a student grab one of the Studio Fs, which was a Kurath F tuba, which is like kind of the polar opposite of what those B&S horns were like. And I finished the recital on a strange tuba.
Wow.
So
yeah,
that was something.
Sure.
I hope not to repeat again, but the show must go on, as they say.
Yeah, I mean, nothing like something like that to really make you hyper-focused, I would imagine.
No, it was, you know, the deal is when you go out on stage, you know, anytime that you go out on stage, you're ready to go on stage and you're ready to do your thing, you know, no matter what happens. And so it was the only thing that was different was, well, it was the pitch was a little more squirrely than usual, but but you know, it's what I trained to do, so I had to finish up the job. So
yeah, sure.
Yeah.
All right. On this day in 1915, John Len Chapman, better known by his stage name Memphis Slim, the American blues musician, was born in Memphis, Tennessee. So Dave, if you could, using that nickname style, what would yours be? So that's where you were born and your body type.
David Annapolis Mesomorph Zirkle. It's not sexy, but it's accurate. So
Annapolis Mesomorph. I love it.
Yeah.
Great. It's almost like the Xenomorph from the Alien movies. That's great. Okay. In 1939, Joanne Castle, American queen of the honky-tonk piano and accordionist for the Lawrence Welk Show from 1959 to 1969, was born in Bakersfield, California. So this is very similar to the last one. So she was queen of the honky-tonk piano. You would be blank of the blank tuba.
Oh, that's a tough one. I am blank of the blank tuba.
Yeah. Comptroller of the brass tuba or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I would have to say the avoider of the virtuoso tuba.
Oh no. Okay. All right.
Although I have to go back. That's the first time I've ever heard Lawrence Welk and honky tonk used in the same sentence. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's entirely possible that the website where I'm getting this information is not 100% accurate. But
honkytonk.com.
Well, there's a On This Day in Music History website, so that's what I use for these. And I mean, you know, I'm not doing a dissertation here, so I don't really care if it's right or not. It's just for entertainment value. All right, and finally, on this day in 2010, Mike Edwards, an English musician in ELO, was killed by a rolling hay bale at the age of 62. Which is pretty weird. So my question is, what bizarre or some could say legendary way would you want to go?
Oh, that's a great question. If one got to choose one's own bizarre way of being exterminated, but that's pretty dark.
It is dark.
Well, I'm going to get back to you by the end of the hour. That requires some careful thought, so...
Okay, all right.
I'll be thinking dark thoughts through the remainder of our chat. So,
well, that was going to happen anyway. That was...
On This Day in Music History.
All right, that was On This Day in Music History. So, Dave, what is the last song that you had stuck in your head?
Oh, you know, there's a very fun... My tune that I go to when I'm singing... like idly around the house is ridiculous. It's there's a bright golden haze on the meadow. There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. The corn is as high as an elephant's eye, and it looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky. So, oh beautiful, what a beautiful morning is stuck in my mind most of the time.
All right. Interesting.
Which is weird.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Huh. Do you know when that started?
I would say probably about 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay.
So, interesting. And it's been stuck. That's my, if I have a default song that comes out of my mouth when I'm at the house singing, that's it. Sometimes I sing, there is a bright golden hose on the May Day, and I screw things up a little bit, but yeah, that song sticks for some reason.
Okay. All right. That's very interesting. I did not see that coming.
By the way, I would like to be licked to death by a dozen puppies.
Nice.
That's the way I'd like to die. I've thought about it.
Good. So. All right. That didn't take that long. Licked to death by a dozen puppies. That would be epic. All right. What's something that you're into right now that isn't music?
Oh, cooking. Cooking. Okay. We do a lot of cooking at our house. My wife, Kristen, she's a much better cook than I am. We have this discussion. She has more skills. She has more craft. But she says, but you always pick things that make people happier than I do. So we've just moved out to Ann Arbor. But Kristen and Ella, daughter Ella, were in Athens for daughter Ella to finish high school. So I was living in a bachelor pad down in student land where I had a first row seat to beer pong out my window, which was awesome in its own way. They never invited me over, which I'm okay. But I did not do a lot of fancy cooking for myself that year. I was a frequent flyer at Trader Joe's and did a lot of that. But since we're all in the same place now in Ann Arbor, we spend a lot of time thinking about what we're going to cook and exploring as many bourbons as we can. I kind of jumped off the Scotch rails and onto the bourbon rails, and so it's all research and development from this point, which is brutal. It's a bad job, but somebody's got to do it.
So what made you jump off the Scotch train? Did your taste sort of change, or did you just kind of get tired of it?
No, it was a funny story. One of my trumpet colleagues at the University of Georgia, Brandon Craswell, was getting married, and it was officially the first plus one date that I brought my spouse to, and we were at the wedding, and he said, "Zirkle, the reception is going to be either beer or bourbon." And I'm like, "All right." So we get to the reception. It's a lovely wedding. We get to the reception, and we bump up to the bar, and they say, "Well, if you like bourbon, our choices are Jim Beam or Basil Hayden." And I said, "I've never heard of Basil Hayden before." And I said, "So I'd like that. Neat." And that changed bourbon for me, because when I was a youngster learning how to sow my wild oats, the bourbon of choice was either Jack Daniels or Jack Daniels. I mean, so it was kind of and it was usually consumed in excess and mixed with some sort of cola product. And so I never really had an appreciation for how a really nicely made bourbon could taste. Mm-hmm. So now I'm a sipper and a big fan. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Very good. When you were a kid, what was your favorite show or cartoon?
Oh, well, I have a lot of them. I was a Stones guy, the Flintstones. I watched the Flintstones. I know every episode of the Flintstones. I watched a lot of I Dream of Jeannie. Mm-hmm. I watched a lot of Gilligan's Island. Those were big things on my list. You said something in that question that was going to take me a different way.
Favorite show or cartoon as a kid. Yeah.
No, yeah, those would be it. I'm a huge fan of the, you know, all the old Warner Brothers, Looney Tunes cartoons. And frankly, it's a goal in life of mine. I don't think it's ever going to happen, but it's a goal of mine to be hired to play a gig where it's the music of Carl Stallings. Because if you think about what those people had to do and those studio musicians had to do to turn on a dime like that for those cartoons, it was wild.
Oh yeah.
And so to write that music, his writing is brilliant. And mm-hmm. so I really paid attention to that. But for me, I would have to say that I'm a I was a Flintstones, Gilligan's Island, and I Dream of Jeannie kind of guy. I always tell my students that I learned my scales fingering them on the side of the sofa while I watched the Flintstones. You know, yeah. So when I was doing my all county band scales, I would practice my scales by just doing the fingers on the sofa.
There you go. Yeah. No, I used to do a lot of just like finger practice on like my hand or on my desk during class or whatever, anything that.
That's how I made it through ear training in college.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I always think that singers have the hardest time with ear training is they've got no physical point of reference. Piano players are doing this, string players are doing this, brass players are doing this. This got me through fingering through everything I was solfeggio, got me through ear training class. And I was pretty good at that class, but this really helped. So
Yeah. Nice. What was your first job?
My first job, I was a busboy at the Rustler Steakhouse on Alternate 40 in Frederick, Maryland. Then in high school, I went on to work mostly at movie theaters, which is like the easiest job in the world, and it gives you the benefit of really being able to get into any theater in town for free. Yeah. So I loved it. That's where I learned my love of Windex and paper towels. But other than that, I mean, that was like the easiest job ever for a high school student.
Yeah.
The hardest job I've ever had was when I dropped I went to Peabody for 4 years and then went off to Illinois State University for grad student, kind of sight unseen. And while I loved my teacher at ISU, he was like one of the best men I've ever known in my life, Ed Livingston. Mm-hmm. My playing was not going to be moving along while I was there. And so I decided midway through the first year that I was going to be kind of one and done. So then I got the indignity of going home and my dad introducing me to his friends that would come around. Hi, this is my son David, who just dropped out of graduate school. So that was a self-esteem booster. But I needed to find something to do. And I got a job. I got hooked up. My uncle had a business in Black Mountain, North Carolina. That made climate control boxes for scientific study. Sometimes they were climate control rooms, sometimes small boxes, but I was essentially, I worked in a sheet metal shop, you know, and I did that. Wow. I did that for probably about 8 months. And so one of my things was I would sit and eat my lunch pail lunch. And every day when I'd sit up and open my bologna sandwich, I would go, "Damn it, I wish I would have kept that music ed degree because I would be standing in front of a band now and having something to do with music." So, but then I got the field band job from there. So that's why I quit the sheet metal job, was to join the Army, which I never thought I'd do. So,
So was it, did you sort of like get into the sheet metal job and kind of immediately think, "I'm going to practice a whole bunch"? And
No, I went in practicing a whole bunch to start with. You know, I think I was still, you know, when I left Peabody, I had the illusion that I could make it in music. And so that had not been dashed at that point. So I still worked very hard. I took the field band audition because both my teachers that I'd had to that point, Dave Bergunier from the National Symphony and Ed Livingston, started their careers in the field band, and they recommended it as something to do. And then they'd run down the list of people who also played in the field band, like Ron Bishop and Harvey Phillips and Ev Gilmore from the Dallas Symphony, and kind of a who's who of players that started their career in that band. And I said, "Well, if it's good enough for them, it's certainly good enough for me." I didn't think that I was going to make the military my career, but I kept getting to the end of enlistments, and it was like, "Well, do I have something better to do?" No, I don't. So I stayed in for 11 years until I found a different line of work. So
All right, very interesting. So, what of your non-music jobs? What was your favorite one?
Oh, I would have to say, I hate to sound lazy, but I really like the movie theater job.
Yeah, no, that sounds awesome. That sounds great to me. Yeah. Yeah, I love that. All right. What is your currently your least favorite activity?
Oh, that's a great question. We just moved into a condo, so I've got no lawn work to do, no yard work to do, which is good.
That would normally be one of your least favorite things is yard work?
My dad was a little anal retentive about the yard growing up, and he was a workaholic. So he'd come home from working too hard at his job and then work too hard in the yard, and we would always get enlisted to join him. And boy, I resented it with a fiery passion. I liked riding the lawnmower. I mean, that part I liked, but the idea of pulling weeds and stones out of the garden and doing other things, I didn't really enjoy it. I have to say, Matthew, I lead kind of a charmed life right now because I don't really have an answer for that question. There's nothing about my life where I go, oh God, this. Yeah. And so I'm a pretty happy camper. You can find joy in anything, you know? Sure.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Yeah. I grew up in Arkansas and we had like an acre and a quarter. And I'm bad with memory. I'm going to say like 10 or 11, we just had a push mower. And so like, you'd like have to push mow the acre, which would take forever. That was, you know, most of a Saturday. But yeah, once you got the riding mower, that was a lot more fun. Now, something I used to love to do with the riding mower is when I was done, because we had like a pretty big hill in the pasture area, I would pull the riding lawnmower up to the top and turn it off and put it in neutral and then get it going as fast as I could down the hill. Did you ever have any opportunities for fun riding lawnmower shenanigans?
No. I always feared that I was going to tip over, like on an incline, you know. I always had this dark fantasy about, you know, the mower rolling over on top of me and being squished like Mr. Bill. But no, that never happened. I will say this about cutting the grass, and I make this, it's not really a joke, actually. It's okay. Make this observation about mowing the yard or painting a bedroom. It's so rewarding as a teacher to do both of those activities, because you get on the mower, you cut the grass, and when you're done in an hour, you look up and you can see that what you did was better, which is the opposite of teaching private lessons, because much of the growth that students have is incremental, and rarely does the student walk out of the office and you go, there, I healed them, you know. The idea of
fixed.
The idea of seeing a tangible result it has wild appeal to me, especially as an educator. So,
yeah, sure. Yeah, I it's sort of along the same lines. That's one of the reasons I really love like doing like producing in the recording studio, because you get to take the stuff that was done and then you fix it and then it's done, and it will always be fixed how you did it, which is a lot of fun. As a kid, what was the best present you ever got?
I would probably say a bike that I really wanted.
Okay.
You know, I grew up in the day where kids woke up in the morning in the summer at the crack of 10 and then spent the rest of the day outside, you know, I had a free range childhood, you know. When I think of the stuff that my parents let me do as a kid, like how long it took to bike to the community swimming pool and the major highway that you had to cross on your bike to get to the swimming pool. It's kind of like, what were they thinking, letting us do that? But my childhood really was very neighborhood oriented, and we were outside all day. It's it's one of the advantages of growing up before the internet took us all over, you know. Yeah. So, those are some of my favorite memories. But my bike was kind of my lifeline, and so that was a big one.
Okay. Did you have a nickname as a kid?
Zerk.
Zerk. All right.
Zerk. Yeah. My brother was Zerk, and to all of the people who are older than me, I was Little Zerk. And but I was Zerk all the way through high school. When I was in the field band, they called me Z-Man. And now everyone in there, all the students, I'm not Professor Zirkle, I'm not Dr. Zirkle because I don't have a doctorate, but I'm not, but there's a culture here of everyone is Professor this or Professor that. And so I'm like, no, DZ is the way to go. So my students in Georgia started that and it stuck. So
yeah, you just preferred it. And now, all right, I like it. Zerk, Little Zerk, Z-Man, DZ.
Yeah.
That is the, it's the whole Zirkle nickname arc. I love it. What is something you used to dislike that you now like?
Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, that's a pretty popular answer.
Yeah, I've come around on Brussels sprouts. My mom just cooked them until they were unrecognizable, cabbagey smelling mush. Yeah. And so now that I've had a properly prepared Brussels sprout, I'm on board.
Yeah. That's fairly recent for me as well. I still can't do the ones that are frozen. Those are still awful to me. But if it's a fresh one that's prepared and, you know, roasted or whatever, it's, I can do it. I had to keep trying it every few years because my wife has always liked them. And every so often she'd be like, well, just try one, you know. Until very recently, it was always like, yeah, no, these are still terrible. What is your favorite musical term? Based solely on how it sounds when you say it?
Oh, I have two, and they both lean on my German heritage.
Great.
One is schwer.
Okay.
Okay, and the other is wuchtig.
Oh, yeah, I like that one.
Yeah, wuchtig. I like getting the... it's the whole, and I like what it means because there's not a good English equivalent for you. Rarely do you say to a student that just needs to sound more weighty, you know? And so when I say to a student, wuchtig, they look at me and say, what the hell does that mean? But then I tell them. And then when I say that from now on, they get it.
I almost feel like too, that just the saying of the word kind of indicates how you should play.
Yeah, schwer.
Yeah, yes. You know? That's good. I like that one.
Actually, we use schwer around our house. You know, if I catch my daughter in a grumpy mood, I say, why so schwer? And so she gets it.
Yeah, that's good. If you were to be introduced running out of a tunnel like an athlete, what would your hype music be?
Oh, what would it be or what would I like it to be?
Well, let's do both. What would you like it to be?
I'd like it to be the opening of the finale to Bruckner 8.
Okay.
You know, that would be pretty impressive. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Every time you went on stage, I love it.
Yeah.
And what do you think it would actually be?
The hot cross buns, probably.
Okay. Maybe at least like hot cross buns and some very loud brass choir-y version for weight.
Yeah. It would be the Pittsburgh Symphony Brass Section playing Hot Cross Buns.
Hot Cross Buns.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. I'm hopefully coming soon on an upcoming album. Superheroes are very popular these days. If you could be honest, as a kid or possibly even as an adult, did you ever try to see if you had any superpowers?
No. Oh, okay. I mean, we did some. Well, I grew up in the era of Evel Knievel. You know,
yeah.
Is that you're down with that? So
yeah,
Evel
sure.
Knievel was this, for the youngsters out there, was this motorcycle daredevil, and he would jump cars and he would do tricks and do these things. And Evel Knievel was very much in the pop culture thing. So when we were kids, we were into, you know, I mentioned we biked a lot, and we would make these makeshift bike ramps. And so here's what we do to simulate Evel Knievel's cars. We'd lay our friend's bodies down right at the end of the ramp, and we jump over our friend's bodies, not long ways, just short ways, but you know,
sure.
And just to be safe, you know, our abdomen is totally exposed while our friends are jumping over us with their bikes, but we wore football helmets to make sure that it was safe. So
there you go.
Yeah. So that's... I wanted to be able to jump on a bike like Evel Knievel could fly on his motorcycle. You know, that was the superpower I wish I had.
Physics.
As an adult, I haven't really, Hell, there are so many things that I can't do that I would settle for just like regular power.
Regular power, right?
Yeah, the ability to double tongue for more than two measures. You know, that would be my superhero.
I like it. Yeah, I just settle for power.
Any power.
Any sort of power would be fine. Yeah, I love that. So doing the bike jumping thing, I'd imagine there was a race to see who could get closest to the start of the ramp, because that's the least likely to have your intestines smashed.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. If you were the first one in on the body count. And I think we rarely did. I don't think anybody ever did more than three. Fortunately, there were no accidents from that activity that sent anybody to the emergency room. We played a lot of tackle football, you know, with no pads in the backyard, and people would occasionally end up at the orthopedist as a result of that. But, you know, it was different. It was different, oh, sure. Man.
Yeah.
But I think maybe I was the fourth of four children. And I think by that point, my parents said, well, whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And
I've heard
it's
that.
Like, yeah. Yeah. That, and so I think they were very, here, I can put it two ways. Either they were very hands-off and laissez-faire, or they just trusted me to learn from my mistakes.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. I think I like that one.
That's I think good. It was a combination of the two, frankly.
Sure. Yeah. Was three people the most that ever got jumped? Do you remember?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
For people that still don't know and maybe can't picture Evel Knievel, do you know like what the, cause it was it always cars that he put together?
Always cars, but I think one of the things that he did toward the end of his life is he had this supersonic bike hooked up where he tried to jump Snake River Canyon, you know, and it was unsuccessful, you know?
Yeah.
And listen, I mean, this was before the age of YouTube. You kids can go look up Evel Knievel and check that out and see some of the just wild accidents that he had. But you would always see the photo reel of his accidents as he was getting ready to do his next stunt. So he would do a lot of things at Caesar's Palace. And
right.
Yeah, he was kind of crazy. One of the highlights of my career in the field band is we played in Butte, Montana, which was where Evel Knievel lived. And he did a presentation at the concert where we were. So I was like, yeah, Evel Knievel.
Yeah, that's cool.
Rock on.
Yeah. Do you know off the top of your head, like how many cars his record was?
In the 20s. I mean, I think 23, 24, or something like that.
Yeah, no, it was really impressive. I mean, I remember seeing the videos. It's impressive to see. What non-music product would you sponsor or be a spokesperson for?
Something I would lean toward, although they don't need it and they don't have any spokespersons for their product. But it would probably be for NPR, you know, just for the quality of their reporting and for the endeavor of having even though it's probably not happening at the rate I'd like to see it, but for their sincere endeavor of having an educated population. And I know that people, you know, my friends on the right will call National Public Radio National Proletariat Radio and say that it's skewed heavily left. But I think the programming is thoughtful and thought provoking I don't go a day without a serious NPR fix. And so that would probably be it. Either that or these shoes. I'm taking one off right now.
Yeah, please do it.
Merino shoe. Here's what the Merinos. Buy Merinos. These are the most comfortable shoes I've ever owned. They're like Merino wool, and they're great without socks, and they're really the most, that's become my go-to gift now. So if it comes time to buy somebody a present, I say, what's your shoe size? And I buy them a pair of Merinos and they thank me. So
now do you always wear them without socks?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm going to avoid asking you to show your feet for any foot fetish.
No, I'm not going to show you my feet.
Okay. All right.
Gross.
Maybe Maybe for a bonus episode or a repeat calendar.
Or if you've got any enemies that you want to threaten, this could happen to you.
I don't know why I haven't thought of it till now, of having a guest feet calendar to sell as a sort of bonus thing. I should have been asking everybody all along. What was the first concert that you ever attended?
Oh, you know, my parents, I grew up in Frederick, Maryland, and my parents had the Baltimore Symphony would do probably 4 run-out concerts to Frederick a year. Mm-hmm. And while I was not a ticketed member of my parents' subscription, very frequently one of them wouldn't want to go. And I remember going to TJ High School in Frederick and hearing the Baltimore Symphony play, and sometimes I was into it and sometimes I was not. And what led me to get more into it as I got fidgety in my seat was that I put myself in the place of the composer. And I said, somebody had to write this. Somebody actually had to compose this and invent this in their head. And for me, that made going to those concerts a lot more pleasant. When I was in high school, I was not, I mean, I like the typical, I'm a Zeppelin fan. I like, you know, it's kind of the music that was going on when I was graduating high school was 1981. And so I was down with some of it once the disco went away. But for me, I was more of a Maynard Ferguson, Buddy Rich, Louis Belson, the big bands. So I listened to a ton of Maynard when I was in high school. Okay. And so that was really my jam. And so I did get to see the Ferguson band. When I was in high school, I saw the Ferguson band probably 3 times. I saw the Count Basie Orchestra. So for me, that was what I would get excited about.
Yeah. So this may lead into the next answer. What's the best concert you've ever been to?
Oh. You know, from a purely entertainment standpoint, I would say Springsteen.
Okay.
Because that guy can entertain. That guy's a great, he puts on a great show and just pours his whole self into his concerts. And so actually that was one of the best concert events I've been to. I have a hard time sometimes going deep into my Rolodex for classical music concerts that just made me go, oh, I've had a lot of really positive experiences in concert halls, and so it's hard to pick out favorites, you know?
Yeah, sure. No. All right. When was the Springsteen show? Or have you been a few times? Or
no, just once. Actually, it was very funny. We had friends. My daughter played soccer, and one of her teammates was her parents were huge Springsteen fans. He was an investment banker, so they were looking for great seats in Atlanta, you know, to get as close to the stage as they could, mm-hmm. and so they would go on Ticketmaster and say, I want the best available seats. And if they didn't get close enough, they would just keep trying. So they had like a dozen extra seats that they, you know, they sold it to us for a reduced cost. But we went and, they, you know, we were nowhere close to the action, but it was a great show. It was, that would have been probably about, my daughter graduated high school in 2000. So that probably would have been about 2010, I would guess.
Okay. Yeah. Not that long ago. Yeah. All right.
said the old guy.
No.
Yeah. Well, it's very funny. My chronology after the year 2000, it's like, it happened in the 2000s. I'm like, I can't pin down when really important things happened in the 2000s because it's just a wash to me. It's like all the 1900 dates I can remember really clearly, but if it happened after 2000, I'm just guessing.
Forget it. So. Yeah, right. Yeah, no, I get that. You've been granted a wish to never have to practice one thing ever again, but you'll always be able to play it. What is it?
The John Williams Tuba Concerto.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I like it. Is that, I mean, I know that we talked about in the recital earlier, is that a piece that you've had to do several times?
No, I did it once to say that I did it.
Gotcha.
My, you know, I'm the John Williams attorneys will be on me right after I say this, but you know, my gripe with that concerto is that, you know, he made a bazillion dollars writing great melodies, and it was a shame that he couldn't put one in his tuba concerto. So
yeah,
that's where I am with that. And then I feel like some of the stuff in the last movement is just not very idiomatic for the instrument, and the cost to reward ratio is off for me. So
gotcha. Yeah.
I'd like to be able to play it. I didn't like it. You know, I heard the piece a lot of times before I heard a performance that I liked. Okay. Wastine Badzvik's performance is great. And then my former doctoral student, Simon Weilman, who's playing in the Marine Band. Sure. I went to an Army Band conference once where Simon played it from memory and standing up. And it was just like, boom, he just killed it. And yeah. And I couldn't understand why people weren't throwing their underwear on stage when it was over. You know, it was just that good a performance.
So. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's awesome. I don't know if Simon was at WVU when I was doing my doctorate. And so I think I like ended up maybe coaching him in some chamber music a couple times while I was there.
Yeah. But,
he's great.
He's a great player.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really great player.
So obviously, you know this, we steal music from other instruments all the time. What's sort of your least favorite and favorite stolen piece that gets played on tuba or euphonium?
Oh, I'm going to burn in hell for this.
No, let's do it.
Professor Kenzig had a history at University of Michigan of students were required to play movements of Bach cello suites in master and studio class. So okay. When your time came up in studio class, you had to bring in a movement of a Bach suite. Okay. I think the Bach suites are great. They're great music, no doubt. Sure. Does that mean they should be played on the tuba? I'm not all the way there because it's okay. Not very idiomatic playing. And right. I had a one-off lesson with a student recently who came in and said, I know you don't really like Bach on the tuba, but I'm going to play it anyway. And so I played it anyway. And we had a lengthy discussion, you know, about what was going on. My position is as a teacher is this, is I want you to study and play music that you have a remote possibility of sounding like an artist on. And I just don't think there are very many tuba players that can make good art out of the Bach cello suites just because of the physical demands and the breathing demands that are required with playing them. Yeah. And so when students bring those into me, I happily teach the musical angles of what I'm teaching. I happily teach the technical and sound angles of what I'm teaching, but I can't wait till we get to something else just because I don't think anybody who plays a wind instrument and can't circular breathe has a fighting chance of playing those things as effectively as they deserve to be played. So,
yeah,
I tend to borrow an awful lot of horn music. So,
okay. Yeah. Would something like that be some of the best stuff that you like?
Yeah. I would say, I don't mind playing Bach if it's a piece that's for a wind instrument. So I've done the Partita and that's fine.
Right.
Done the E flat flute sonata and that's fine. It's just when you have to, you know, theoretically go for, you know, 12 measures without coming up for air where it's just like, this is stupid. Why are we doing this? You know? So,
right.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of in teaching. I'm a big fan of building from what you can do well. And so the idea of picking something that you knowingly cannot do well, nor will probably ever be able to do well, I think in terms of growth for students, I think it's self-defeating. So I want people to go from where they can and not from where they can't. So.
Yeah, that's great. Hard pivot. What's your favorite nut butter?
Peanut butter is the only nut butter in my
as
life.
Far as you're concerned. Gotcha.
And it's chunky peanut butter.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Natural or?
No. I'm kind of a slut when it comes to my peanut butter. I'm kind of a Jif guy. So.
I want to thank you very much for giving me definitely a quote that I'll be able to use. I'm kind of a slut when it comes to my peanut butter.
Well,
I appreciate that. That might even be the title. Dave Zirkle, peanut butter slut. Okay. Let's play a little game right now. This is one of the worst segments in all of podcasting. Let me find the, here we go. Nope, I lost it. Here we go. You ready? We're going to play a game called Rorschach Test.
Rorschach Test. What do you see? Rorschach Test. What does it mean? There are no wrong answers, but there's definitely some weird ones. Rorschach Test. You might want to unpack that.
All right, Dave, it's time for Rorschach Test. I've got five of these. I'm just going to show you the picture. You tell me what you see, okay? You ready? Here we go.
The female reproductive system.
Okay. All right. I would ask you to go into more detail, but...
I prefer not to.
I wasn't going to. Yeah. Okay. Number two. Please don't say the female reproductive system.
No.
I'm going to sense a pattern.
Two gnomes high-fiving each other.
Yeah, all right. That's a very popular answer. I was going to say if like three or more of these are female reproductive system, you're going to have to see an actual psychologist at the end of this. Okay. Here's number three.
Oh. That's a giant working a jackhammer.
Okay. Yeah.
With his big feet.
Yep. I like it. All right. Road crew giant.
Or you could imagine. Are you familiar with the movie Raising Arizona?
Not enough to know references.
That's good. Put that on your queue.
That's a good one
to watch again. It's plenty absurd. I would think that you would really enjoy that movie.
Okay.
But it's the antagonist on a motorcycle from that movie.
Gotcha.
That will come to you when you watch the film.
Sure. And won't be able to see anything else after that.
Right.
That's good. Yep. Yeah. No, I should check that out. I've got that. And then I've got merino shoes to look into.
Slutty peanut butter.
Slutty peanut butter. All right. Here's the fourth one.
That's some sort of moth or bat.
Okay. All right. Blown through these. And finally, the last one.
Oh, that's interesting. Boy, the rest were like this.
Yeah.
I don't know. The top of it reminds me of like the tuning pegs for a cello. Mm-hmm. It looks like a cello that has been filleted.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would be my answer.
Yeah. No, that's, I've gotten that and very, very similar ones before too. So okay. Yeah, no, I get it.
All right. You can send me the diagnosis when this is over.
No, as I tell most of the guests, I am not qualified to do this. I have no idea what any of it means. I really just wanted to write a theme song and thought this would be stupid. So that's, that is what happened. That was
Rorschach Test. What do you see? Rorschach Test. What does it mean? There are no wrong answers, but there's definitely some weird ones. Rorschach Test.
That's definitely about your mom. All right. Dave, thank you for playing Rorschach Test. You won. Congratulations. Have you ever experienced anything paranormal?
No, but I'll tell you a story.
Okay, great. Yeah, please.
When I first started at UGA, I went on a recital tour, and this was probably in the year 2002. And on the recital tour was the University of Michigan. And when I was leaving with my accompanist from the recital, I said, I don't think this is going to be the last time that I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
Which is weird. And then I learned about, I applied for the job when I was working in a different city. I mean, I was off doing orchestral work in a different city. And I was in that city for 2 weeks, and the number of people that I encountered in this city, which is nowhere close to the state of Michigan, it was in Utah, the number of people that I saw wearing Michigan gear and Go Blue gear was really weird. It was after I had already applied for the job.
Yeah.
And so it was like, is this a sign, or is this just a weird coincidence? So that would be my answer to that. Not paranormal, but eerie enough to mention.
Yeah. Are you, have you been someone who looks for signs normally?
No. It's very funny. I was married previously, and my first wife is a wonderful person. She's a great human being. When I was on the audition trail, I'd go to an audition and not come home with a job. Her answer to me was always, things happen for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And for the longest time, I thought that was the biggest rationalization in the world. And I would get upset when she'd say, things happen for a reason.
Yeah.
This wasn't supposed to be the one. It's like, well, that's comforting if you believe that. And then there came a time finally where I did take an audition where I was right down to the nub for a big job. And I was the only one in my family who wanted to move. For this job, I was the only one who wanted to go. My kids were, firmly ensconced in high school where they were, and middle school where they were. They didn't want to move to the city that was in question. And that was the first time when I didn't get it. I thought, well, maybe this is for the best. Maybe this is the right reason. So I'm not looking for signs. I'm heavily I'm heavily in the camp of what happens to you in life is a result of your preparation and adaptability. And so to look for things that are signs, I don't always prescribe to that.
Yeah. I don't know about you, but I feel like the sentiment of everything happens for a reason is a really nice one. But I feel like when it's being said to you about something that didn't go the way you wanted, to me, it feels a little dismissive as well.
Yep.
Of the experience. It's just like, oh, well.
Yeah.
Everything happens for a reason. So,
well, and trust me, I mean, anybody in our field has had enough failure to choke on, in terms of auditioning.
I learned to Heimlich myself.
Trying for things. I always encourage my students here. I say, don't start taking auditions only when you think you're ready. Mm-hmm. I said, you need to start learning how to do that process now. And so you know what to expect. And so that you do know that the normal result of an audition is there are 99 people who didn't get the job and one person who did.
Right.
And so, there's kind of this idea of, getting used to not getting the result that you wanted and then growing from there and seeing what you need to address in order to make that happen. So,
yeah. Yeah. What are you most afraid of when it comes to playing?
That's a weird answer. I'm afraid of, people not liking what I'm doing. Or people not finding that my playing is worthwhile. Mm-hmm. I've long ago accepted, Matt, that I'm not going to be the cleanest player in the world. I'm not going to be the guy that people go, oh my God, that was like perfect. So what I'm going for in performance is, did I make somebody think? Did I make somebody feel? And so what I worry about sometimes as I look up from my music stand mistakenly and look out into the audience is like, am I saying anything worth hearing? And so I guess that would be my answer. You know, just making, I don't ever want to be just kind of a, you know, of something that somebody could MIDI just as easily. You know, I want my music to have some artistic content to it. And I worry sometimes that I'm not getting there. So that's what I focus on in terms of my worrying. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that, maybe how you deal with that changed over the years, or do you feel like you're more often are saying something that you want to say?
Well, here's the thing where I've landed was that there was a period of probably about 3 years ago where I said, screw it. I'm done with live performances. I'm not going to go out and trot myself out for recitals or concertos anymore because I'm always pissed off with the product because it's not perfect, you know? And guess what? You know, nobody does perfect performances. I think we're all weaned on edited CDs and mm-hmm. edited projects where we go, oh my God, that playing is perfect. Mm-hmm. Well, how many takes was that? Or how many times did it take to go through this material to get something that was put out as perfect? And so I had some arguments with some friends of mine who were musicians I respect a whole lot, who told me that I was crazy for saying that was going to be my angle, that I'm just not going to put myself out anymore. And then I had conversations with students about giving yourself grace, you know, giving yourself room to be imperfect. And as I feel like as long as I still have something to say, chances are it's not going to be perfect. But if I can, that's why we do art. We do art not for ourselves. We do art for other people to consume it and to make them have some sort of reaction. If they hate it, that's a reaction. We did our job. I mean, if they hate the piece of music, that's okay. We put it out there. We gave it to them. And if they hated it, that's cool. That's a reaction. But, you know, the worst thing that, you know, can happen is to get done a performance and neither have someone say, boy, that was great, that was really exciting, or it's not the end of the world if they said, boy, I really hated that third piece on the program. Yeah. But it's when they say that was all right, you know, and it's like, well, then I didn't do my job, you know.
Yeah not having an opinion is worse than having a strong one in either direction, for sure. That leads into a couple of other questions, I think. Has there ever been a period where you truly disliked playing the tuba?
No. Okay. You know what? You know, I feel like I've had so many lucky bounces in life, you know, and to be able to, I pinch myself that I'm able to do what I do and make a living doing it. And so sometimes I get really angry with the jaded musician who bitches about their work, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, shut up. I mean, this is like you're playing your instrument for money, you know. It's there's nothing to bitch about. Stop it, you know. So no, have there been times where I've been frustrated with things that I can't do? Yeah. Sure. but you just gotta suck it up and keep working on the problem, you know. And so no, there's never been a time, never ever once been a time where I'm like, not this again, you know.
Yeah. All right. What I was just thinking about this yesterday as I was listening to something in the car. Who's a composer that you are quote unquote supposed to like that you could do without? But I mean, go with somebody, you know, dead, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll have Franz Joseph Haydn's lawyers on my doorstep. I would have to say Haydn because of the classical period. I kind of feel like I kind of feel like their music is so, it's elegant in its simplicity, but I find its simplicity not very engaging sometimes.
Okay.
In terms of harmonic language, I mean, they were masters of form and they were cranking out works like nobody's business, and they were genius for where they were. But I don't like listening to a Haydn string quartet. That doesn't do anything for me. So
yeah. Okay. All right. Interesting. Are you surprised with where you are and what you're doing now? Did you see yourself doing it maybe 10 years ago?
No, I mean, I'm thrilled to be doing what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. I think when I was at Georgia, I loved teaching at Georgia. It was a, I didn't love living in Georgia necessarily, but I loved my studio. I always had a really good studio of thoughtful kids, and the university supported a lot of those kids, especially the grad population. They supported those students generously, and they're, the last 12 years of me teaching at UGA, I just loved coming to work because I had like great and interesting people in my studio, and it was a lot of fun. When I was at Georgia, I thought there would be three jobs that I could apply for that would cause me to leave the University of Georgia. One was the University of Michigan. One was Indiana, and Dan's 80 years old and going strong, and I don't see him retiring until he has to. And then Northwestern, and Rex retired, and then they kind of have done it. They're kind of, Northwestern is a little, well, I shouldn't talk shit about another school, but I think Northwestern for me is a little sad making because that was a place that was legendary for brass teaching, especially when I was coming up. You know, everybody left where they were and went to Chicago to study with Chicago players. Mm-hmm. And I think the idea that they've gone to more of an adjunct model for their teaching studios, I think does a disservice to the students. So,
yeah. Okay.
So, but those were the jobs that I thought about leaving, and then or that I thought about leaving for, and I applied to this one, not thinking that it was going to happen, but it was, as another, just one more lucky bounce that I got, you know?
Yeah.
So,
no, that's great. Okay. You, are given free rein. I want you to make your, fantasy chamber music supergroup. It can be any instruments, people living or dead. Who have you got in your all-star fantasy chamber music group?
Does it have to make sense from a musical standpoint?
No, not at all.
Okay. Glenn Gould. Glenn Gould on the keys.
Yeah.
Yo-Yo Ma, Joe Alessi, John Fletcher. I'm going to stop there because I'm about to pull something thinking about it. But those are all musicians that I've Oscar Peterson, if we had to have somebody extra on keys.
Okay.
If we're going to have someone sing, I'm going to pick a really banal answer that people go, oh, yeah. But it would be for Sarah Vaughan or Ella Fitzgerald. So, I mean, those are a list of musicians who I really admire. So,
okay. I guess speaking of this kind of not mattering who's in the group, what's the oddest chamber music configuration that you've ever personally played in?
Oh,
or has there been anything? Is it been
more sweet? There's a piece for by Morton Feldman called Durations, and it's for piano, violin, and tuba. That was one, and it was a lot of it was kind of chance music. It was, you know, no two performances of it would be the same because you're holding out pitches, not in any sort of metric time. So that was weird. I did a piece on my senior recital at Peabody. It was my master's recital at the University of Maryland that my teacher was super pissed that I programmed. And it was called Fantasy for Tuba, Timpani, and Piano. And it was a composer friend from Peabody by the name of Brian Zulch, but he wrote this kind of as a joke for a friend. And it was tuba, timpani, and piano, and it was made up of 60s TV themes.
Okay.
You know, and so and he used the pen name of Zebedee Willikers was the composer. And so that was a weird one. Tuba, timpani, and piano. Yeah. And then I recently did a piece at UGA I had put out a feeler for a piece for tuba, oboe, and piano. And one of my composition faculty members said, "You do know you've got composers on faculty here." And so he wrote a piece for tuba, oboe, and piano, which was actually a very effective piece. So
yeah, cool. Nice. At Duquesne, there's a piece, if you're not familiar, called Grand March, which is for euphonium, piccolo, and rubber ducky, squeaky rubber ducky. So that was probably mine. Have your have your students keep an eye out for that one.
That's valid.
They need something. Okay, just a couple more, and then we'll do a little game and some bonus episode stuff. Do you do karaoke? And if so, do you have a go-to karaoke song?
Well, last time I sang karaoke was under the influence of alcohol in a bar on the road with the United States Army Brass Band. And me and three others got up to sing. And what we sang was the theme from the Flintstones, but in operatic style. So that was the last karaoke I did.
Okay.
So that's a hard no.
It's a hard no. Yeah, gotcha. I don't know that I could do it without alcohol. I don't understand.
Yeah, no, who can do no, and it's the people who are schwer about it. The people who are very serious about what they're doing. It's like, oh no, part of my stomach goes a little flippy when I see people trying really hard to succeed.
Yeah,
I think. Yeah, well, at that specifically.
Sure. Yeah.
Not generally.
Okay. What's the most fun you've ever had on stage?
Oh, that's a great question. I would have to say, well, it was playing with the Philadelphia Orchestra, and it was, this requires a little bit of a story. They did one audition, they didn't hire anybody, and they said, "Nobody who auditioned, we don't want to hear you again." So they did a second audition, and I, since 75% of my competition was out of the way, I did the second audition, and it got down to me and Steve Dumain at the end, and they were going to give Steve a trial week, and so they gave Steve a trial week in September, but they looked at me and said, "Do you have any availability this summer?" And I said, "Whoa, I just happen to have my summers off." And so I did probably 3 or 4 weeks with the orchestra that year, and it was for their man summer season, and what that meant was, you played a rehearsal in the morning and you did a concert that night. And then the next day it was a new program, rehearsal in the morning, concert that night, 4 nights a week. And so we were churning through rep. And I think the first concert I played, it was a Shostakovich 5. And it had very little to do with what came out of my bell, but it had everything to do with sitting on the inside of the machine and just listening to that, especially the winds. You know, the Philly strings get all the love, but that wind section in that orchestra is astoundingly good. And so it was, I think that was the most excited I've ever been after a concert.
Yeah. What did you learn from your best and worst, and maybe it's the same thing, best and worst professional experiences?
What I've learned from my best professional experiences is that it's exhausting. If you've given a really great performance, if I've given a great performance and I've put my whole self in, when I come off stage, I come from a sweaty people. So that's part of the thing. But just be the sensation of being physically wiped out. I feel like if I leave a performance and I feel that way, it means that I was heavily invested in the performance, and chances are that it went pretty well. There have been bad things happen at concerts sometimes. You know, some mistakes happen and things don't go the way that you had planned. And what I've learned to do, and it took a little while to get to this point, but it's just to brush that off and say, okay, well, that was fascinating, and I hope that doesn't happen again. And what can we do to make sure that doesn't happen again? And it's an opportunity to learn something, you know. So for me, bad performances, I tend to try and shake off. I always tell my students, when you make a mistake in an audition or you make a mistake in a performance, I said, it's like hitting a squirrel with your car. You can get out and look, but the squirrel is still dead, you know. So the idea of getting out to look is going to do nothing for your positive mind frame for the rest of the performance. So it's just like, so if a mistake happens, you just have to go, well, that was fascinating. So it's time to move on. I think that there's a book that I love by Ben Zander and his wife, Rosamund, who's a psychologist, and it's called The Art of Possibility. And it's a great read for musicians, but it talks about, you know, kind of giving yourself a positive mindset. And, you know, his premise is everybody gets an A, you know, and it's like if they don't have the pressure of knowing that they're not going to get an A, it opens them up to being more free with their thinking and their art. So it's a pretty interesting book.
Yeah. Okay. Can you give me your key to successful performance in 10 words or less?
Don't wet the bed, period. Always say something worth hearing.
I like it.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. Don't let the bed always say something worth hearing. Love it. Who was the most influential person in your early musical development, and who is the most influential person for you now?
Oh, it's going to go back to my, well, this is, I mean, there's fan fiction and then there's like real life. For fan fiction, I would say that John Fletcher, even though I never met John Fletcher,
yeah,
he is the person, the first real tuba soloist that I ever heard with the Vaughan Williams recording. And ever mm-hmm. since I heard that and all the Philip Jones records and the London Symphony stuff, I've wanted to sound like John Fletcher, and I'm still trying, and it's probably never going to happen, but I'm still trying. And that's my model. And so as a developing tuba player, that he was kind of my role model for what I wanted to do. I didn't have a lesson before I went off to Peabody. I'd never taken private lessons with anyone. And so Dave Bergmunier, even though he was considered a little bit of an old school guy, when he was studying with him at Peabody, he was kind of near the end of his career. But I couldn't get enough of him playing in lessons. And that's mm-hmm. why students have to suffer with me playing through lessons, because I feel like in a lot of times when you're teaching, the quickest way from point A to point B is to demonstrate. And you know, Charlie Parker that said, writing about music is like dancing about architecture, you know? Yeah. And so it's the whole idea with trying to explain something verbally that you could paint with an example of playing was important to me. And Dave Bergmunier was really formative for me in that way. I wanted him to play in lessons all the time because I needed to know what it sounded like.
Yeah.
These days, I look at people who are really gifted at the craft of teaching. And so I would have to say that at the top of my list these days, I just read a great book by him. And it's what Whiff Rudd is doing at Baylor with his trumpet studio. He wrote a great book called Side by Side, and it's a companion to applied music teaching. And just the environment that he creates within his studio, and what a great motivator he is, and how inspirational, and the program that he's built at that place, it really impresses me. Anybody who teaches really well, I'm kind of in awe of, you know. It's because it's hard. It's not an easy thing to do. So
yeah, sure. Okay, great.
And still John Fletcher. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. What in your plane requires the most and least maintenance?
Oh, the most maintenance, low register needs the most maintenance.
Okay.
It's one of those things, you know, I think if you pay a lot of attention to your low register, your high register doesn't go away. But I think if you pay a lot of attention to your high register, your low register will go away. And so that's an area of my playing that I have to work on a lot. And multiple tonguing is something that I have to work hard on. But fortunately, I'm a tuba player and I can choose my way around having to multiple tongue. You know, I often tell people I would rather eat a bowl full of glass than play Carnival of Venice in public, you know. So there's that. And what do I have to work least on?
Yeah.
I would say that I'm so comfortable after playing for a long time. I'm so comfortable with the way that I produce sound that I never get to a point where it's like I really need to fix something that's going on with my sound. Having said that, I start my playing day every day by playing simple melodies, by Brad Edwards' Simply Singing book. That's usually the first thing that I crack during the day. And it's just, I never want to pick up the instrument and do anything that doesn't have to do with the musical outcome. That's why I always found the Arbenz book so frustrating, because I find it to be pretty dry. Mm-hmm. And so Brad's books, between Simply Singing and Lip Slur Melodies and Patterns and Snippets, I feel like Brad Edwards pimp sometimes. I promote these things so heavily. But I find those to be really good books in an appealing musical package. And so you're taking care of some fundamental things, but you know, my go-to line is, it's like giving a dog a pill and a piece of Velveeta. You know, the dog just thinks he's getting something that yummy, but he's actually getting something that's good for him. And so for me, that's what those Brad Edwards books are. It's a chance for me to take care of my fundamentals, but within a really musically appealing package.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Okay. We're going to do a rapid fire either or segment. I'm going to give you two options and you just tell me which one you prefer. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Ready? Binge watch or binge eat?
Binge eat.
Large ensemble or chamber music?
Large ensemble.
Chamber music or solo performance?
Solo performance.
Great hall or great piece?
Great piece.
Support role or solo spotlight?
Support role.
TV or books?
Increasingly books.
Talking or listening?
Listening.
High notes or low notes?
High notes.
All right. Written or improvised?
Written. Sorry.
Yeah. No need to apologize to me, of all people. Would you rather miss a note or miss counter rest?
I'd rather miss a note.
Playing loud or playing soft?
Oh, I'd much prefer playing soft.
Melody or harmony?
Harmony.
Opera or Broadway?
Opera.
Would you rather perform when you're too hot or too cold?
Too cold.
That goes back to the sweaty people, I would
sweaty
assume.
Sweaty people,
yeah. Going out or going home?
Going home.
Text or email?
Old school email.
Okay. Would you rather hear a tone-deaf soprano or an amateur thereminist?
An amateur thereminist.
Okay.
That would be entertaining, I think.
Thereminer? Thereminist?
Thereminer?
I'm not sure.
Theremino?
Thereminite? I like thereminite. I like that. Okay. Hearing a piece you love or discovering something new?
Discovering something new that I love.
Okay, Sure. When you were in high school, were you more likely to be out of tune or out of time?
Out of time.
Soft pretzel, hard pretzel?
Hard pretzel.
Interesting. I don't know why that one's the most fascinating one to me so far. would you rather do a vegan Thanksgiving or a sugar-free Halloween?
Sugar-free Halloween.
Okay. Spit valve or spit take?
Spit valve. There's much more spit valve in my life than spit take.
Okay. Tuba or forba?
Tuba.
Euphonium or they phony you?
Euphonium.
Slide grease or the movie grease?
Oh, although I was singing something from the movie Grease, I would
Ooh,
have to
okay.
go with Slide
Have to
Grease
go with
because
Slide
I
Grease. Okay.
just, yeah.
All right. Tuba choir or doing your taxes?
Yeah. Tuba choir.
Okay, all right. Drumsticks or the band sticks?
The band sticks.
Okay. And a tonal or a tunnel?
A tunnel.
Okay. All right. Very good. Whoa, whoa, hey, hey. Skip the repeat.